G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truthtoyou.org. That's truth2letteryou.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, Yoel.
G'day to you too.
So, are your feet purple? That's what I want to know. Do you get purple?
No. Actually, no. What happens is that for the color to actually stick, you have to let it sit for quite a while. You'll be surprised, but you can actually make white wine or white grape juice from purple or red grapes. The whole idea is that when you leave the skins and everything, that's when it starts producing. That's where it receives the color. So you really have to sit in there for a while for actually for anything to happen. My guess is that by now it's starting to go purple. This is actually a variety that's not just red; it's actually purple, and that's how you get the color basically through the skins.
Okay, so just for the listeners, because I don't know what we're talking about. If you go to Yoel's Facebook page, it is Hebrew in Israel. You go there. There is a link, by the way, on the right-hand side of truth2you.org, truth2letteryou.org. You click on that; it'll take you there. Yoel has been making wine the old-fashioned way. Do you want to give us the details? Not only that, but you're doing the video. This is the first video that you've made.
This is the first video I made. I did promise last week, and I'm beginning it, making sure that when I promise something, I actually do it. And it's also, I think it's kind of important for people to actually see who I am. You know, I've been a voice up to now, and there has been one picture up on Facebook of me on a bus ride on a tour I joined last year. Mm. And I think it's about time that people start seeing, you know, who I am. And I actually do want to explain why I haven't done anything like this up to now is because I was actually living in a very Orthodox area. And I do know that there are people who would not appreciate any of this stuff, anything that I do. And, you know, people knew my relationship with a lot of people from around the world. But I do know that there were enough people out there that were very disturbed by certain things. So I prefer to downtone a lot of stuff up to basically now. Like, well, now that we moved, no one actually bothers me anymore about anything.
Now you're out in the middle of the desert. You're out in the middle of the desert. You can be who you want to be, and no one is persecuting you. No one is getting on your case, right?
Yeah, no one's actually getting on my case. I have been, you know, pulled aside for conversations with different people, you know, and very condescending conversations sometimes. And, you know, now that that's over, thank God that's over, I can actually be a bit more open about certain things. And so, yes, now I feel a lot more comfortable putting videos up. I think it's about time, you know, people see who I am, and I have no longer a voice.
Speaking of that, are we able to reconcile the two Yoels, or would that cause worlds to collide?
So we can reconcile the two Yoels. Yes, there actually has been two Yoels. My actual surname is Halevi.
Yoel Halevi.
It's not Ben Shlomo, it's Halevi.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Shlomo is the name.
That's your stage
it's not
name.
It's actually
what
not
are you
a
talking
stage
about?
Name.
Yoel Ben Shlomo, that's the stage name.
No, actually it's not, because when I'm called up to read from the Torah, I'm actually called up as Yoel Ben Shlomo, so it's actually my real name. So again, if there's anyone out there that's like, how dare you or anything, no, it's quite normal. And you have to understand something, there are people out there that monitor this stuff, and basically look for people here in Israel who might be, you know, Christians or Messianics and stuff like that. And I've been confronted. You know, I've been asked in the past by different people if I actually believe in Yeshua, mm-hmm. you know, because of the connections I have. And I basically usually answer like this, and I say, first of all, it doesn't really matter what I believe. It's none of your concern. But if you ask me, you know, what do I do? And my answer is, I am interested in developing the belief in the God of Israel around the world. I'm interested in helping out people understanding the word of God around the world, regardless to what they believe in, how they see things. And if they believe in Yeshua or not, it is irrelevant, because we have a mutual cause, which is to believe in the God of Israel.
Amen.
And, you know, it doesn't really matter anymore, you know, the Judeo-Christian argument, because the people I deal with are not Christians. They don't come with a Christian, the same Christian mindset. I mean, for Jews, you know, one of the things is that Jews don't really kind of confuse Christianity together with the Hebrew Roots movement and all the other names which are attached to the basic idea of people who believe in Yeshua, who do not come from a Jewish heritage or do not come from a Jewish background, who do believe they have to practice Torah. You know what I'm saying? You look at the Tanakh and you never see this idea as if, you know, we're supposed to close ourselves away from the world. And I can understand the history, but I think that if a person walks up to me, and this has happened, this has actually physically happened. I was speaking with someone about different things. The guy walks up to me, grabs my tzitzit and says to me, teach me. I could not say no to that person. I actually immediately said yes, and we started. And, you know, and I think the massive change happened when I decided to restudy the book of Isaiah, and I realized that Isaiah is not just a prophet to Israel, he's a prophet to the world. You know, each one of the prophets have prophecies about the nations. Now, obviously, in many cases, these are issues of condemning the nations for things they did for the people of Israel, against the people of Israel. But you, when you see verses like, you know, every month in a cycle, people from all the world will come to bow down to the Lord God of Israel, it makes you think for a second. And I reached a point when I basically said it's unfair if we keep this information away from people.
True.
And that's where my so-called kind of like career and what I do today began, realizing that teaching Hebrew to people is very, very important because it enables people to have a direct contact to the Bible itself, to the words themselves. Mm-hmm. I am a bit saddened about certain things that have been developing throughout the years where people have turned the study of Hebrew into kind of a lot of weird things I've heard, you know, but the people I've taught, you know, it's an eye-opener. The lessons I give are never just, you know, here's the grammatical stuff. You know, students kind of like, you know, turn around to me after a while and they've been studying Hebrew and they're learning the vocabulary and everything. And they say, I noticed something. And they start telling me what they noticed, and it's a pleasure to hear that because you know when I teach, I'm not trying to just teach you the technical stuff. I want to push students into a point where they realize things by themselves, and it's a wonderful feeling to see a person develop from a point where they had no Hebrew background to a point where they're reading, they're understanding, and they're seeing things they couldn't see when they were reading the English.
Amen.
Or whatever language it was, if it's Spanish, if it's German, if whatever it would be, it's amazing. And it's an amazing feeling that, you know, I can actually say I have a part in helping people get closer to God. And it's a wonderful feeling. So I have to say it's an honor to actually be on Truth to You. And it's an honor.
And it's a privilege to have Yoel ben Shlomo, or Yoel Halevi. Yoel ben Shlomo, of course, Joel, son of Solomon, right?
Yes, my father's name is Shlomo.
Shlomo.
Needs a lot of prayer at the moment because, you know, I get information about his condition every once in a while. He's a bit better now. Here's a good piece of news. He's feeling a lot better. And hopefully I'll be able to see him in January.
In the States?
Yes, in the States. And if anyone wants to meet up with me, I will be in the New Jersey, New York area.
And at the moment, it's looking like January at the moment. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's looking like January. I want to thank everyone that did help with collecting money for a ticket. Wherever you are out there, I actually don't know any names because Jonah's keeping that away from me.
No, they were all they're all anonymous, and it just makes me so happy that I know something that you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So what's happening is it's going to happen in January. Hopefully, I'll be able to be there for about 10 days to 2 weeks.
Okay, so January. So if people are in the area, the New York, Jersey area, who would like to meet up with Yoel, again, can I give them the Hebrew in Israel email address?
Yes, of course.
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. Also, if you would like Hebrew lessons from the Levite in the land. And, of course, Yoel Halevi is Joel the Levite, right?
True, yes.
we're going to be talking about – now, I'm glad that you're here, my friend, because we're going to be talking about the Levites very, very soon. But before we do that, couple of things. Now, we hang on. We didn't. No. Before I even get onto that, Yoel, I want to talk about you. You suddenly had inspiration to go and jump into a bucket of grapes. Just fill us in on the video that people can watch if they go to Hebrew in Israel.
So what happened was that my wife's father, wonderful man, basically says, we're living in the land, let's eat off the land. Mm-hmm. And for years and years and years, there are actually pictures of my wife as a child pressing grapes.
Oh, truly?
In the same bucket.
Oh, really? Wow.
And my wife's father worked in agriculture for several years. I think it was like 15 years or something here in Israel. He's kind of like a tree doctor. He knows like so many things about plants. It's insane. You know, I walk around with him and he go, oh, that tree was trimmed the wrong way. It should have done this and that. And he basically has a small area around his house and he planted a vineyard there. A very small one, produces a few liters of wine every year.
Nice.
Edible grapes as well. For example, in Hebrew and Israel, there's a picture there of a vine with where the grapes are covered with paper bags. That's actually his. That's the same vine above my head, by the way, when I'm pressing that.
Yeah, okay. I've seen that.
He actually taught the owner of the winery in their area, in the Gush Etzion area. He actually taught him basically almost everything that has to be known about making wine. Mm-hmm. There's an amazing blackberry wine type of thing that he gave him the recipe. It's an amazing, amazing beverage. I mean, when your wife comes back to Australia, I'll probably buy her a bottle and you send it over. You can taste it.
Oh, my goodness. I'm missing her. I should let everyone know she's over there at the moment. She's over there at the moment. She's been there for, I don't know, it's only a few days, but it seems like it's been weeks already. Hani, a lot of the listeners will know her voice from Cultured Karait when we talk there, and she joins us on the program. But at the moment, she's on a archaeological dig in Herzliya, which is just off the coast of Tel Aviv, right? A little bit north of Tel Aviv. Is that right?
It's a little bit north of Tel Aviv. Actually, has one of the biggest culinary school in Israel. Tadmor. The Tadmor school is actually there. Unfortunately, going to Tadmor requires also learning unkosher things because their certificates are for, you know, bigger things. I have all certificates produced in Israel are international, but there they insist to teach you the unkosher stuff as well. I actually had the kosher course, so I didn't have to deal with the different kind of weird things. But yes, Herzliya, by the way, named after Herzl, Theodor Herzl or Zev Herzl.
Oh, right, of course.
That's what they call it, Herzliya.
I was just going to say, we will be doing an interview with her at some stage in regards to what she is doing, and she'll give us an update on that sometime very soon. But give us a little bit of detail. Yeah,
so also Herzliya is a place I learned to play didgeridoo.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah, I used to go there once a week before work. I used to work in the evening, so I used to go in the morning, mm-hmm. sit there and learn how to play didgeridoo with my instructor. So what happened there was basically there's a point somewhere around the middle of August where there's enough sunlight and the grapes have a decent quantity of sugar in them. Mm-hmm. And that's when it's the right time to actually press them and make wine out of them. And basically what happened was that my kids were with us. So the older kids were kind of bored. And my wife's father says, you know, let's take them out and press. It's a Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't working. I had to work that day. You know, Sunday's actually a pretty big day for me. Mm. And he said, you know, that bring the kids over to stomp the grapes. So they went in for one moment, said, we don't like this, and they jumped out. And I basically said, well, someone has to pick and another person has to press. So what we did was they were picking and I was pressing with my feet. Yes, I did wash my feet. We cultivate the pressed juicer with something else, not fungi off my feet. And so I kind of thought for a second, this is a cool thing we can take a video of. So I pulled out my cell phone. I gave it to my wife and I said, okay, I'll film it. And she did. And this is, by the way, the first attempt to use my cell phone with the filming program on it.
She did a really good job.
Yeah, she did. And by the way, that was it's a raw video because this was like a inspiration of the moment. And I went to upload it on Sunday because I knew more people were able to see it on Sunday. Mm. And it's been pretty amazing. It's received quite a few shares. Hundreds of people have seen it. It's a pretty nifty camera. It's a really nice camera. I really like it.
Sure. Well, in any case, that's also on Hebrew in Israel on the Facebook page, and we're looking forward to more videos of you as you travel to significant areas of the land or activities, as it were, with you treading out the grapes. So that was a marvelous thing to watch. I'm really glad that you put that up, and I'm looking forward to more. Now, we are going to do Judges, of course, and I've already mentioned we're going to be talking about the Levites. We're going to be talking about the tribe of Dan. Now, speaking of Dan, I want to give a shout out to Dan. G'day to Dan. I really like Dan Yoel. Let me tell you why. He sent me a really nice pair of Sennheiser headphones. And
Sennheiser. I had headphones by Sennheiser.
I'm wearing them now, and it feels like my head is being hugged. It's like my brain is being cuddled. They're so nice.
Why don't I get things like that? I want a Sennheiser.
and the sound is so good. So that's Dan from North Dakota. And and Yoel, he and his wife are going to be joining us on the 3T tour.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
I've actually received messages from people saying they're going to show up on the tour, and I'm very, very happy to hear that. We are preparing things, or our ideas being thrown around. I'm actually hopefully going to be speaking with Keith either probably tomorrow, I think, because today he's going to be kind of busy, and we're going to plan a few things out. And yes, by the way, he did tell me that the promo of the time series that we made is about to come out.
That's the one.
Yeah, I'm actually waiting for that.
Excellent.
Kind of been on the edge of my seat for quite a while because I really want to see how that came out. I actually want to see also what I look like on that video, because that's from March, and that's like 5 months ago. I want to see how much weight I actually lost.
You've lost half a Yoel since then. What's going on? I mean, you look great in this video. Everyone should go to Hebrew in Israel Facebook page, watch this video. You're looking really well. Now, listen, I was going to say, 3T Tour. Okay, so there is another button on the right-hand side of truthtoyou.org. You'll see the Israeli flag there. Click on that. It will take you to the page with the details where you can register. It is in the first half of March next year, the first couple of weeks of March next year, where you can get on a tour with Keith Johnson, myself, Yoel Ben Shlomo, or Yoel Halevi, depending on how he feels when he wakes up in the morning, and a few other people as well. It's going to be great. And also, as you just mentioned, Yoel, there is the Time Will Tell video that is coming soon, and we have been on the edge of our seats, and I'm waiting for it. Apparently it's imminent. We'll let everybody know when that happens, but you are on that as well. Where are we? We're in Judges chapter 17. Shall we kick off?
Yeah, I think we should, because we've been chit-chatting for quite a while.
We've been schmoozing for a while, so we better get cracked.
You won't, as I always say, you won't be Jewish if you don't schmooze.
Schmooze. Now, there was a man, Yoel. He was from the mountains of Ephraim. And now, you told me that you would take me there. I'm really looking forward to that. There was a man from
I used to live in the mountains of Ephraim. So, yeah, it's interesting mountains there.
Yeah. Whose name was Micah. Now, is that how you pronounce it in the Hebrew?
So, in the Hebrew, we pronounce it as Micha.
Micha.
It might have been pronounced as Mika, because there is a discussion were there double-sounding consonants in Hebrew originally. Big discussion by itself. I'm not going to go there. But there are evidence that at least some accents of Hebrew did not have softer sounds for certain consonants. They're called the Beged Kefet. But it's actually a short name of Michahu, and happens to be actually quite a common name in the ancient world, where some would say Micha someone, something. So we have Michaihu, which means Mika Hashem, okay? Mm-hmm. Who is like God. We can also have, there are cases from texts where we see names instead of the name of God, we have the name of some pagan deity. So this is quite a common name. We also have, for example, Michaihu ben Yimla mentioned in the Book of Kings. We also have the prophet Micha HaMorashti, mentioned in the Treasal. So this is a name that actually has quite a few examples of it. So Michaihu in this case is the way that it's written here. Obviously, he's mentioned here. It's very interesting what happens with his name, because as long as he doesn't do something, as long as he doesn't worship other gods, he's referred as Michaihu. But when he does the famous sin mentioned in the story, he suddenly turns into Micha. He's no longer Michaihu, so the name of God is removed from his name.
Do you know what? There's an example, Yoel, of something that we miss in the English. That That is not here in the English. So it's very interesting that if you can point out when that shift takes place, that'd be good. But in any case, Yoel, he had a mother.
By the way, this is actually quite common. We find this in the Book of Kings as well. When the king is righteous, he's something Yahu. Mm-hmm. And when he isn't, he's just without the Yahu at the end. The Bible uses a lot of these little things, these subtle things to hint different ideas, because basically the Bible doesn't cut slack to anyone. If someone's doing something wicked, we make sure you know of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the Bible's point is to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So help them God, literally.
Mm-hmm. Amen. And we're about to read some pretty blatant examples of that. He had a mother. Do you know what? Yeah, well, one thing that strikes me is that we don't know what her name is or where she's from. It just says there's a dialogue that takes place with his mother, but her name and details aren't there. Is that unusual?
First of all, it's not unusual. It's very rare to mention someone's mother's name. Some of the only characters we actually have in the Bible, the name of the mother is mentioned, are the kings of Israel, mm-hmm. kings of Israel and Judah. Some of the only characters we actually have the names of the mothers. We also have Moses. We have a mention of his mother's name.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quite rare. It's considered to be quite rare that the mother's name is mentioned, because people's heritage really went through the father, mm-hmm. Which raises a lot of the issues. For example, a person's genealogy, through where does the genealogy actually carry through?
Yeah.
Or defining Jewishness of someone originally was through the father,
mm-hmm.
and it was changed at one point to be through the mother, and the different theories why it happened. But essentially, in the ancient world, it was always, for example, people were always named after their father. So, for example, Yoel ben Shlomo, I'm mentioned after my father's name, not my mother's name, mm-hmm. and it's very rare. One of the rare cases, for example, are the sons of Tziruiah, Yoav and Avshai, or Avishai, depending where you read it, and Asael. They're the only ones who are mentioned after their mother's names, the sons of Tziruiah, who happened to be the sister of King David. But it's very, very rare that the mother's name is actually mentioned.
Okay.
The other thing regarding the place of living, this is actually a very, very important thing, because it's a very important part to the story that we have here, is that there's actually the rabbinic tradition that says that he lived, I think, in a place called Regev or something like that. And they say that Regev, actually, I think it's Regev, I'm not too sure 100%, was actually very, very close to Shiloh. And the tradition goes that the smoke from the altar of Micha and the smoke of the altar in Shiloh were mixed up in the air. You can see the two pillars of smoke going up, and they were just mixed up in the air. And we have to understand the idea of why this story is brought here. We're basically done with the judges. Now we're giving a background, a historical background, on what was going on.
Mm.
And there are several interesting things that happen here. First of all, the Danites. The Danites are mentioned here again after the story with Samson.
Yes.
And it gives us history of what's going on here. The Danites were having trouble with the Philistines to begin with, so they couldn't really had difficulty inheriting, so they really lived among the Philistines, so they're looking for another place to live. That's the historical background of what happens in the next chapter. And also, the two stories we have here, the story of the statue of Micha and the next story, deal with two separate ideas. Here we're dealing with the spiritual implications of what was going on at the time, the confusion, the problems. Mm-hmm. And the next story we have is more the moral behavior between people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking with basically two stories, two case stories that give us an insight to what was going on. Basically, look at the darkness that's going on, leading into the book of Samuel, where salvation begins, where redemption begins, mm-hmm. and when the light starts, the dawn begins.
Yes.
In saying that, what we have here is a very, very important story, because what it indicates is the issue of confusion in what they're supposed to be believing in. And we're actually now reading the book of Deuteronomy, and we just read the parasha of Re'eh, mm-hmm. and it talks about worshipping in a very, very specific location,
yes.
and not making certain mistakes. So I think it's pretty awesome that we're reading this now in conjunction to where we are now in the Torah portion.
Very good.
So this
point.
Is a very, very important story that we all have to learn from it. yes, what was going on.
That's a very good point, because as I read through this, when I was reading it earlier today, and of course it reminds me in so many on different levels the sin of Jeroboam, but we may get to that. So I'll just read it through.
The sin of Jeroboam is actually connected to you. I'm going to bring up that point later on as well.
Excellent. Okay.
Please remind me.
I will. He said to his mother, so he has this conversation with his mother, and he says to her, and it picks up, it seems like it picks up halfway through a story. It says, the 1,100 shekels of silver. Now, that's an interesting thing. You remember we talked about...
By the
about
way, the Hebrew doesn't say shekels.
Really?
The Hebrew says the 1,100 silver. Remember, a shekel is a weight.
Is a weight,
yeah. When he says silver... It might be that we're just omitting the word shekel and someone added in, for example, or there was some other tradition, say from the Septuagint or something, that added the word shekel and everything. By the way, there are a lot of grammatical anomalies in this text. There's a lot of problems with the text itself grammatically. So it could be the word shekel is missing here from the Hebrew text. I prefer not to go in that direction, because throughout the years it's been discovered more over and over and over again that the Hebrew text is a lot more accurate than other texts mm-hmm. that we have. Mm-hmm. Different things where they say that, oh, there's a correction here, and they corrected, say, 50 years ago they decided to correct, and now we have a better understanding of the Hebrew language and the biblical Hebrew language, then we realize, okay, this correction here is completely incorrect, and really the original text is
right in the first place.
Yeah. Shekels doesn't appear in the Hebrew text. By the way, the amount of money here, again, this is the same number that each one of the five kings or masters of the Philistines gave as well.
Mm,
notice that right. as well.
Quite right. So and we talked about that last week.
We talked about that last week. Yeah, to Delilah. And this exact same number, which is very interesting as well.
Yeah, it is. It certainly is. But so 1,100 shekels of silver, 1,100 of silver that was taken from you, Micah says, and on which you put a curse, even saying in my ears, here is the silver with me, I took it. Now, first of all, Yoel, it seems to me, I mean, we're picking up obviously halfway through an event here, but she realized that silver in her possession had gone missing. She cursed the person who took it, and he went, ooh, that's me, I better give it back. Is he doing that to avoid a curse, do you think? Has he got a guilty conscience?
It might have been one of two things. It might have been that he got scared. Mm-hmm. Because his mother put a curse. And by the way, it reminds me of a comment that someone put up about the issue of a curse that's in vain that never happens, quoting from Proverbs. I can't remember the person's name. It was a comment, I think, on the last program we did. And the answer to that is that how do you define a curse which is in vain? If someone did something against you and you cursed them, that's not a curse in vain. It's when you're a righteous person and someone tries to curse you, then that's a curse in vain, and God goes like, whatever, I don't care about your curse. Mm-hmm. But when someone actually commits a crime against someone, and that person who's affected by the crime puts a curse on that person, it could be that curse will happen. So it's not a curse in vain, just to clarify that. But again, thank you for pointing that out.
And so she put a curse on
But the other thing could be that he actually his conscience kicked and he went, okay, I made a mistake. And he gave it back to her.
Okay. And his mother, in any case, Yoel, she's not that phased. She said, oh, may you be blessed by Yehovah, my son. So
no, that's not what she does. That's actually not what she does.
Really?
She doesn't go, oh, blesses on you. No, she actually goes like, my son is blessed before the Lord, because she's trying to reverse the curse.
Really? That is fascinating.
That's how most of us see it. But she's basically saying, you're blessed. And she, not only that, she invokes the name of God to probably protect her son from the curse she put on.
No, I was just going to say, I didn't pick that up. I didn't, when I read it in English, I did not pick that up, but that makes perfect sense.
And the other thing is, in the culture where blessings and curses are pretty, I don't know, in the Western culture, people don't understand this. You know, for people who are blessing or cursing, oh, there's a witch standing over a cauldron and putting a curse over someone. You know, you have to have superpowers. In this part of the world, it doesn't work like that.
Sure.
Sometimes when you say something to someone, they immediately ask you to take it back.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the culture here, people are scared of stuff like that. You know, when someone, you know, when if someone tries, you know, to curse someone and say, no, may God do X, Y, Z, you know, in this culture, in this part of the world, people go like, no, please take that back. And,
it's fair enough that they should feel like that, Yoel, because when we look at the examples of the Tanakh, words have weight, words have gravity, words have authority. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. And in the ancient world, naming something, giving something a name, defines it. So, for example, if we go back to Genesis, where it says, "And Adam gave first man gave names to everything," he wasn't just giving them names. Oh, that's a lion. Is that in the ancient world? They believed that by giving a name to something, you're also defining what it is. You're giving its character. You're giving its reality as a creature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they perceived it. So the same thing, you know, when you open up your mouth, the same thing. For example, taking an oath. Today, the world has gone to a point where, you know, your words are worth nothing. You know, you promise something that never actually happens. Mm-hmm. And it's a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and for example, when someone in the ancient world would take an oath, a person would invoke the name of their God. And, you know, the Torah says that in his name you will take an oath, you know, to invoke a higher authority. Mm-hmm. But even without the higher authority, we have to learn to realize that if we don't keep our words, if we don't speak truth to one another, we're basically causing humanity and society to crumble. Sure. And we still have, you know, when you, I don't know, you pledge allegiance to someone, God takes it very, very seriously. We have the story, for example, with Zedekiah. He mentions in the book of Jeremiah that he took an oath to King Nebuchadnezzar that he will not rebel against him. And know what? God turns around to Zedekiah and says to him, You've desecrated my name because you took an oath as my representative on earth,
mm-hmm.
saying that you will not rebel, and you did rebel. And he's actually told off for that, which is very, very interesting. He's threatened through the prophet about what he did. What we say, what we promise, has weight. It's not just that we just say words. Pick your words carefully every time you speak. Doesn't mean you have to walk around paranoid, yeah. But when you promise someone something, if you look at Proverbs a lot, don't say to your friend that you will do something and you're not planning on doing it. Mm. It's just besides being a bad way of behavior, it's also something that God doesn't like.
Amen. Amen. And so he continues. It continues. Verse 3: When he had returned the 1,100 of silver to his mother. His mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to Yehovah for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. And thus,
completely weird. This is so. First of all, suddenly now the money is sanctified. So again, some people say that she sanctified the money. Then, you know, she's using the past tense here. She's saying, Hakadesh Hikadashti, using in slightly emphatic form, right? I've made it. I made it sanctified, but most of us read this as a past tense. But it could be that this is a past tense representing a present tense that she's now sanctifying the money. So it could be one of two things. Now that the money is returned and she's trying to protect the son, she says, "I'm taking this money and I'm sanctifying it to God." You know, saying, you know, the thing he sinned through, I am going to use it for good, so-called good, by the way, and it's going to protect him. Or she really did in the past, that she really actually did sanctify. So there's two ways of reading this. But here's the weird thing. She sanctified it from the hands of her son, from her hands to my son, basically saying, oh, I intended to give this money to my son to begin with. So he never really did anything wrong. Maybe she's very superstitious here. It's one way of reading it.
It's very strange, isn't it? It's a very strange exchange because the pieces of the silver goes missing. She curses the person who took it. He hears it. He's paranoid. He says to her, oh, listen, it was me. I've got it. It's okay. And she goes, oh, that's great. Give it back to me because I'm going to set it apart. To be a carved image and a molded image for you, and she gives it back to him. It's really quite bizarre, but in any case,
she sanctifies it to God, and she actually invokes the name of God.
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, she actually says the name of God here, and she says to make a pesel umasecha. Now, pesel umasecha. If we go back to Exodus 20, it says lo ta'asecha pesel umasecha. No, it says. The one place it says in Deuteronomy, "Lo tasef pesel masecha toevat adonai elecha asher saneh." Okay, don't pesel masecha toevat the abomination toevat toevat Hashem, the thing which is abomination in the eyes of God, which He hates. And then we also have in Exodus 20 where it mentions, "Lo tasech hafer set murat muskol samet tavnit zachar unekeva." You know, and basically uses the same terminology. And we pull out the Ten Commandments. It says, "Yelo yelech ha'ilem ucher panay, lo taseh hafes ha'richot imunah asher b'shamayin imal, asher ba'aretz mitachat ha'shamayin mitachat la'aretz." So he uses the word fesel and tumunah here. So here it says, "Pesel u'masecha." So pesel is a statue, and a masecha is from the root of nasach, which means something which is being poured. It's not just a statue, it's a statue that's made in a pouring, basically, inside a mold. Mm. And actually, they discovered molds of this type. And again, this doesn't necessarily have to be something big. This can be something relatively small, because if we say it's a shekel, it's about 8 to 9 grams of silver. So she actually sanctifies. She only gives 200, but not the bulk of it. She actually keeps 900 for herself. She takes 200. So say 200 pieces, each one of them weighing 8 grams. We're talking about something like maybe 4 pounds of silver, which is still a reasonable amount of money, but it's basically 1,600 grams of silver, and it must have been something like a small statue, maybe a foot high or something like that. Mm-hmm. And she actually says, "And now I will return it to you." She gives it back to her son, but she actually says, "Oh, this to begin with had to belong to you." So she's trying to, my feeling here is that she's trying to cover for her son. "He didn't really steal from me. The curse it was in vain. It was a pointless curse because I anyhow intended to give it to him, and he's blessed to God." Mm. And she's trying to protect him from all directions, spitting 3 times on the floor, knocking on wood, I don't know, whatever.
And doing all of those. But then in verse 4, Yoel, it says, "Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver," and I know shekels isn't there, it's in italics in mine,
not there. Yeah.
200 of silver, "and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and so, they were in the house of Micah."
So he still mentions Michaihu here.
Uh-huh.
But then the next verse says, "V'ha'ish Micha," and the man Micha, he's no longer called Michaihu, and the man Micha, he has a house for Elohim. It doesn't say the name of God. He doesn't say Yud Hevav. He actually says Elohim. "V'ha'ish Micha lo beit Elohim," a house of Elohim. "Vayas ephod utrafim," and he made an ephod, which is a priestly garment, and a trafim. And the trafim, we all know, is an idol.
Terafim, yeah. We know this from Rachel, right, who stole the household gods from her father Laban, we read about in Genesis. So, in Bereshit. So, hang on, let me just go back. Verse 5, this is what I've got in the English, Yoel. "The man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod." Now, we spoke about the ephod when we were in Gideon. In chapter 8, verse 27, it talks about an ephod. And whether these two things are the same, I don't know that we're entirely sure. But he made an ephod and household gods, or teraphim. But what you're telling me, Yoel, is that it says the man Micah had a, not that he had a shrine, but he had a house of Elohim. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, Beit Elohim, a house of Elohim. So it raises the question, was this really like a household shrine, like say some of the Canaanites had? And was he just, you know, he worshipped at home? Or did he really actually make a kind of a temple? And which raises a whole bunch of questions. You know, basically at the time, it shows how big of a mess. People were opening up temples left, right, and center. And there's actually a commentary I read that said the reason they don't mention the place of his dwelling is because it didn't really matter. Anonymous people were building temples everywhere they liked, everywhere they wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, so there, it says it's irrelevant where he lived. He, as an anonymous person, no one knew who he really was, had a temple, not just a room or a corner in the house where you had the household idols, you know, like we sometimes find, for example, Japanese or the Chinese have household idols that they hold,
We talked about an ornamental Buddha last week, for example, sure.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about probably a full-fledged house of worship, probably with an altar and a shrine, a holy of holies, many of them had. If you ever look at the archaeological temple, you know, temples discovered in archaeology, you know, they all had like a little altar in the entrance, which is a very interesting thing by itself. My very good friend Rico Cortez spoke about the issue of the threshold covenant, and that brought up the whole issue of altars which are literally glued to the entrance of the house, and you know, a holy and a holy of holies. He actually had an actual temple. And not only that, the text actually mentions, and he filled the hands of one of his sons to be a priest to him.
He did, but hang on, before we get there, just read verse 6, because verse 6 is kind of the disclaimer, really, of the story.
So it says here, in those days there's no king in Israel, each man does whatever is right in his eyes.
Mm. So really, that is kind of, as I said, the disclaimer of the story. And the reason
I don't think it's a disclaimer. It's not a disclaimer, it's basically describing the reality.
Yeah, it's saying these are the reasons why these things are happening.
We can call it a disclaimer, okay.
And this is one of the stories, you know, and so... And as you mentioned before, it doesn't stop there. The following chapters get even weirder. But it says in verse 7, now there was a young man. Oh, okay. Now, Yoel, this confuses me. I want you to explain this to me. There was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. He was a Levite. How am I to understand that? He's of the family of Judah, but he was a Levite.
Okay, so there are several opinions of exactly what was going on here. One opinion says he wasn't a Levite. His mother was from the house of Levi. But he was using that to claim he was a Levite.
Mm.
There's another opinion that says he was a professional Levite.
What's that?
He wasn't a Levite. He was a Judean. But he walked around claiming he was a Levite.
Ah, so we see a bit of that today, don't we?
Yes, there are people I've met who walk around claiming that they're Kohanim or Levim. And they work upon that. They actually go around and they say, I'm a Levite, and they try to make money off of it. I've met people like that. It's infuriating. And I think, you know, in mega churches they do the same thing as well. Mm-hmm. The guy walks around claiming, I'm a Levite. Now what does he have the right to claim that? You know, is because either the order of Melchizedek is part of the story, which has nothing to do with the order of Aaron. We already spoke about that back. We talked about that. Or that they basically say, well, now that, you know, God has forsaken the people of Israel, we are the new priests because we are men of God, quote unquote. And therefore, we are the new Levites. Give us all your money. That's in mega churches, but that mindset, I mean, again, I'm not here to say anything to anyone, but that mindset is also inside the Hebrew Roots movement, where there are people who say, you know, tithe to me because I'm a Levite. Mm-hmm. And some of these people, some of these people don't even have any Hebraic heritage. These people, their ancestors were, I don't know, whatever, wherever. And I spoke about this quite a few times, and I actually once got a very kind of slightly angry email. I don't know if it was angry or what the point of the email was, but someone was kind of upset with what I said about this, and I'm going to say this again. The fact remains that Levites are genetic descendants of the house of Levi. A Kohen is a genetic descendant of the house of Aaron. Mm-hmm. If someone is a spiritual leader and you feel fit to support them with what they do and everything, that's your issue as a private person. But if you're talking about the issue of tithing, if you're saying, I'm taking 10% to fulfill the commandment of the Torah, the answer is, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
End of story. And there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can argue about it. There's nothing you can do about it. And just to clarify something very, very simple, I have no bias in this because I don't take tithe. Very, very simple. So I'm saying this very, very bluntly. What we have here in the story is more or less the same thing that we sometimes find today. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of harsh, isn't it?
Well, but let me qualify that, because when you say you don't take tithe, at the same time, if someone is to tithe to you because you are a Levite, you can't refuse that. And, you know, I'm just saying, because you are a Levite. But what we do know...
No, because there was one time someone accused me. There was one time someone accused me of trying to take away the tithing inside different movements, basically saying, oh, you're a Levite, you're claiming you're a Levite. And the answer is, yes, I am a Levite.
Yeah.
And the fact remains that I do not promote the issue of tithing for myself. There have been people who have given to me. And I've tried to give it back, and I was told not to. Actually, one person said to me that if I give it back, it's extremely insulting. Because it's a cultural thing. We don't like, you know, rabbis, for example, good rabbis, people that I've met, people would try to give them money, they gave it back. And I learned that from my rabbi, where people were trying to give gifts and stuff, and they gave it back and basically said, you know, don't. You know, if you want to give money, give it to the poor or something. Mm. And I learned that from my teachers, from different people that I've met. And but I was told don't give it back, because when people decide that this is a commandment and they want to fulfill it,
that's right.
You know, don't give back to them because it's insulting. So yes, the fact remains that there have been people who give them to me, but it's still the fact that I don't promote it. I don't go run around saying, you know, give me.
So no, I know you don't, but I just
that's my disclaimer.
That's because there are people who. We've mentioned this before in the program. If they read the book of Malachi chapter 3, verse 10, for example, and they read that and they go, oh, my word, I'm supposed to be, they go, oh, I'm meant to be bringing all the tithes into the storehouse, or there may be food in the house. Yehovah says, try me now on this and see if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be enough room to receive it, and so on and so forth. And people don't want to miss out on that. I mean, if there's an opportunity to tithe to a Levite, a true Levite, then I would say to people, that's certainly something that you should be giving serious consideration to. However, there are people that wander around saying, I think I'm a Levite because I've got XYZ pointers in my genetic test, and I think that could possibly, they said it might be, and therefore I'm just going to say that I am. Or whatever that claim to Levitical priesthood is, you want to make sure, as best you can, find out the details of what they're saying. Because as we've mentioned on the program before, there is a precedent in Ezra chapter 2, verses 62 and 63, that really just says, unless you are absolutely certain of your ancestry, unless you're absolutely certain, then they should not be serving as priests, as Levites, until there is a high priest with the Urim and the Thummim. Is that correct? Have I got that right, Yoel?
Yeah, that's what the book of Ezra says. But I will say this again: if there's someone who's a teacher who helps you, who you admire, whatever it would be the reason, and you decide you want to give them money, that's your business. It's your business, but they cannot invoke the issue of tithing. That is lying in the name of the Torah. We actually have a term for it. It's called Naval Birshut HaTorah. It is a wicked man in the authority of Torah. And I'm saying this, and the reason I'm bringing this up again is because I know of people who don't have any money,
mm-hmm.
and they still give.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that whole story. I remember seeing Keith really angry. I don't know if you remember this. There was that whole story with that bishop, with the wrapping with the Torah scroll and everything.
Yeah.
And you know what I heard about that bishop? I heard there were people who have no money whatsoever. Mm-hmm. They broke into their savings accounts and gave it to him because they believe that that will solve their problems. And these people have barely have any money to pay their bills and stuff like that. And, I, you know, it's just ridiculous. You know, if you're poor and you don't really have any money, you know, if you decide to give, at least give in the right place is fine. You know, he doesn't have to be a Levite. He doesn't have to be a Kohen or something. But at least the person who gives you truth, who actually tells you what the Torah actually says, a person who actually gives you something. There's some guy who runs around on a stage with a microphone and a $3,000 suit saying, oh, prosperity, prosperity. Those guys, walk up to them, give them a good taekwondo kick to the head, and then carry on with life.
Now, you mentioned this is the second time you've mentioned the megachurch, and we're actually going to make reference to that a little later on, because this so-called Levite kind of likes the idea. But in any case, he is not necessarily a Levite. He's of the family of Judah, but it says he was a Levite, and a little bit of confusion there, and he was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place, Yoel. And then he just went out wandering, and then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah as he journeyed, and Micah said to him, where do you come from?
By the way, it looks as if Micah also had some kind of he went through the house, he might have had some place he could stay there for a short while, mm-hmm. until he carries on, maybe to sleep or something. So he might have had some kind of an inn, which could be some kind of like a promotion stunt that Micha was playing with, mm-hmm. that when people came to stay with him, he would promote his temple.
Sure. That's interesting. I wouldn't have picked that up, but sure. And he said to him, so where do you come from? He said, well, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah. I'm on my way to find a place to stay. So Micah said to him, ha, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me. A father and a priest, Yoel.
It's a terminology. Av can be used for different things. So it can be someone respected. Mm-hmm. If you stay with me, we'll respect you. Or is the word Av can be a man of authority. We actually have the example where, for example, Elijah is taken away. Elisha says, "Avi, Avi, Rechev Yisrael u'Farashav." And I actually have a book here with a whole essay about this term. But using the word Av, basically to be a great one. So Av can mean a great one, a man of authority, a respected person, a person in his household. And he also says, not only that, you can also be a Kohen. Here's a promotion. You're going to leave it up to now? Here, be a Kohen now.
Wow, that's a really good way to, you know, that makes sense to me. That makes, here's a promotion. So he said to him, dwell with me and I'll give you a promotion and I will give you 10 shekels of silver or 10 silver per year, a suit of clothes and your sustenance. So the Levite went in, he was happy with that, and the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah...
So by the way, there's a joke that's played on me a lot, because the Hebrew in verse 11 says, Vayoel HaLevi. And people play a joke because it says, oh, Yoel HaLevi. So it's always been a joke that's been chasing me for years. So just to clarify something, the vocalization here of Yoel is about slightly different. It's a segol, the other air, the short air in Hebrew, after under the aleph. So it's not Yoel as the name, it's Yoel from Ho'il, that he was willing, but the joke still stands there. People, every once in a while, someone pulls that joke on me.
You've been explaining that for years. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as priest.
Now you also know the curse has been lifted. He knows that the curse is not endangering him because he's been blessed. He's just received a blessing, which raises a very, very interesting question regarding the issue of how do we identify that God is with us over something? And I think the answer actually lies here, that when you know something is not really correct, there's something faulty, think twice.
Very good.
So someone actually asked me a while back, a couple of weeks ago, said, you know, someone says, you know, I've been doing something, I'm being successful, doesn't mean that God is with me. Mm. And the answer would be, listen, it might mean that God is with you. The question is, what exactly you're doing? So, for example, this person said to me specifically that they were trying to do something and they were praying to God about it, and it worked. And I said, is there any sin involved in this? You know, anything that's against the Torah? And they said, you know, I actually don't like using the word sin, but, you know, is there anything you're doing which is against Torah? And a person said to me, this, I think, you know, are you working during Shabbat? Are you doing this? Are you doing? Mm-hmm. Nothing came up. I said, okay, I think that's a good indicator that God is blessing you and is with you with this subject. And I said, okay, fine, good. But it raises a question. For example, a person says, you know, I'm successful, but I have to steal from people or I have to break Shabbat. But you're successful. It's a question. Mm. Why are you successful? And one of the explanations developed in Jewish philosophy was that you're successful because you're receiving your good fortune for the good deeds that you have done, but you will be punished for what you're doing here. And the different approaches, it's a whole discussion by itself, the issue of righteousness and receiving reward. And, you know, because it could be that, you know, you're succeeding, but you're breaking Torah, and now you're receiving blessing because of good deeds that you've done. Mm-hmm. For example, we take the story of the son of Jeroboam, which I kept on calling Jerobam in the video I did with Keith. Because Jeroboam. In Hebrew, it's Jeroboam in Hebrew. There's mm-hmm. no Jeroboam. There's no extra sound there. And his son was wicked as well, but they found something good about him. So he didn't die the violent death of the rest mm-hmm. of the family. Okay, so that might be an explanation. So he is succeeding because he's done good things. But towards the end of the story, he loses everything.
Mm. Now, that's an excellent point. Listen, speaking of Jeroboam, let's go back a little bit because you mentioned before, of course, that before the Levite came, that the so-called Levite came along, Micah, in verse 5, where you said he's no longer Michaihu, has become Micah in verse 5. And he had made a shrine, he made an effort that he's got his household gods there, the molded image and the carved image, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Now, certainly his son is not a priest. There's no hint there that he's a Levite of any description. And you just mentioned again Jeroboam. We were going to draw some parallels to the sin of Jeroboam in regards to the golden calf and so on and so forth. What are they?
So first of all, having an image representing the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what part of the thing. This is a house of Elohim, but the point was to be a house of worship, the God of Israel. That's number one. Number two, having a Kohen who is not from the house of from the house of Aaron, and more than that, probably not even from the house of Levi.
Yep.
Okay. Really, those are the two major parallels.
Well, no,
the other parallels we might have is, for example, competing with the temple in Shiloh.
That's it.
The same way Jeroboam was trying to compete with the temple in Jerusalem.
Yes.
So what's a third interesting parallel, which I don't think you've noticed, is it might be that this text is actually also giving us the background for some of the major priests that Jeroboam had, because he became the priest of the Danites, which happened to be the people who assembled the city of Dan,
uh-huh.
which happened to be one of the cities where the golden calf was.
True. That is true. So I didn't pick that up. You're right.
It could be that there's a criticism here regarding those priests.
That's a very good point. So that's a fairly solid connection too.
Exactly. Now, this raises another thing that happened in history later on, in the Second Temple period, where there were people who were walking around saying that they belonged to a priestly family, and there were doubts about them. The doubts came from different places, not necessarily what we're talking about the Book of Ezra, but there were people who were claimed to be Kohanim, and they were not really priests. They were people that the authority, either the Romans or someone of wealth and power, gave them, bestowed on them being priests. And there could be, and it could be, for example, that Caiaphas, for example, mm-hmm. Mentioned, by the way, in the New Testament, was not really a Kohen. He was a man who bought the high priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this is a reality that kept on going on. But we have to remember, it's only amongst the Israelites that we find this idea of a priestly heritage as a family heritage. Mm-hmm. Only specific families can be priests, because in the ancient world, you know, you can become a priest if you dedicate yourself for being a priest. You decide you're going to live in the temple and you dedicate your entire life being a priest, which is very, very similar to, for example, what developed in Christianity. You know, anyone who decides to become a priest becomes a priest. Mm-hmm. But here in Torah, and we actually see very clearly that no, you want to be a priest. You can keep on wishing. You can't become one.
Well, no, I mean, you can become a priest, you just can't become a Levite.
No, you can't become a priest.
What are you talking about? David's sons were priests. What are you saying?
No, but it doesn't mean that they were Kohanim.
That's right. It says,
Uvnei David Kohanim LaHashem. It doesn't mean that they actually were allowed to go to the altar and go to the temple itself and be in service. It could be that they were in service inside the temple with other things.
That's right.
But not necessarily actually being an active Kohen or an active Levite on the position of the Kohen and the Levite.
And so you can be one who serves in some respects, but you cannot be a Kohanim, you cannot be a Levite. And, you know, it's not something that can be bestowed upon you, it's something you're born into.
Exactly. But by the way, to clarify something, the word Kohen can function as a substantive, okay, which means we take an adjective and we actually turn it into an actual proper noun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if someone's a Kohen, it can mean one of two things. He can be a person who is a Kohen from a specific family. And so if someone's called Kohen or something like that, they're probably descendants of the house of Aaron. But we can also have it as what's called a participle, which basically means, in Biblical Hebrew, there's no present tense. Biblical Hebrew doesn't really have a present tense. So there's a thing called a participle, which is it has a present tense meaning, but it also can function as kind of an adjective as well. So it's basically what's called an adjectival verb. And the idea is that this person is functioning in a position. So when someone's Kohen or Mechahen, as we usually use it in modern Hebrew, it doesn't mean they're a Kohen. It mm-hmm. means that they're functioning inside a position. So, for example, the Prime Minister of Israel, Mechahen Batafkid, he's function inside the position of being prime minister. It doesn't mean he's a Cohen. So it's kind of an interesting game.
If I can take an example from Bereshit, and you mentioned Melchizedek is mentioned as a Cohen, right? And there's also the priests, Pharaoh's priests of On, they're also described as Cohen, right? Is that an example as well?
That's an example. They are functioning as priests, but when we say in Hebrew a Kohen uses a substantive, we actually mean a person who comes from the house of Aaron.
There it is.
And when we want to say that they're not from the house of Aaron, we turn them into a substantive with an adjective attached to them. For example, Kohanei HaBamot, the priest of the Bamot, the priest of the high places. Or when, for example, we want to say about the Kohanim from the house of Levi, it says HaKohanim HaLevim, the priests from the house, the priests who are Levites, clarifying who they are.
There it is. Thank you, my friend. Once again, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. If you want Hebrew lessons from Yoel, my goodness, he's good. He's the best. The email address that you can contact him on is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. My friend, I reckon we're going to have to leave chapter 18 till next week.
Really?
Yeah, I do, because, boy, there's so much in it. And, of course, our friend the Levite doesn't go away. He inherits a megachurch, but we're going to get to that, but that'll be chapter 18 next week. Is that okay?
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah.
That's what we're doing. Because
I'm quite surprised. We were pulling out a lot of information out of these chapters. I'm quite surprised. Every time I go like, oh, it's two chapters, it'll be fine. Then
that's what I thought. I thought, we'll knock over the two chapters because the two chapters are related and we've got to do it. But of course, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, Hani's in Israel and I've got the kids and I've got so much extra to do during the week. But I don't think that I can do chapter 18 as well. Dear listeners, so you're going to have to wait, but it's worth waiting for. And we're going to get to Judges chapter 18 next week. Thank you, Yoel, once again. Hebrew in Israel on Facebook as well. His first video, people, get on, have a look and watch it. It's great. Making the wine. Is the wine going to be ready for when we arrive?
The wine should be ready. I'm going to ask my in-laws to save, let's see, how many bottles will we need? Well, we'll see how many bottles we have, and we'll basically, I'll save a couple of bottles, and maybe when during that Shabbat that we were going to have together in the hotel, I'll bring the bottles over and we'll
drink. There it is. And between now and then, I'm just going to keep reminding myself that you did wash your feet. In the meantime, dear listeners, join us next week for chapter 18. And if these programs have been a blessing to you, you can also show your support by donating at truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letteru.org. But in the meantime, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kodesh.